All right, welcome to class today. Sorry, I forgot my microphone. Being a Monday, we're going to start by looking at the quiz. So, we did better on question two than question one. Let's start with question two, why don't we? Most of you figured out that the power set of a set with three elements has 256 elements. Some of you didn't. For those of you that didn't, let's just briefly review how this works. I have three elements. The power set of a set with three elements will have 2 to the 3 elements. So the power set of that will have 8 elements. And the power set of a set of 8 elements will have 2 to the 8th elements, or 256. Power sets will always take the 2 to the number of elements in their new set, which you can figure out exhaustively if you want, but there's also this general principle. I tried to pick this example so that trying to enumerate them all was untenable for most of you, but theoretically possible if you're really stuck. Anyway, any questions about question two before we go to all the many things in question one? All right, then we have the 26 parts of question one. Wide variety, some success in the different parts. So let me just talk about a few that tripped up a lot of people, like half of the class. We were very much split as whether Q is a subset of the power set of Q. Okay, so remember Q is a set containing 4 integers, 2, 3, 5, and 7. For it to be a subset of some other set, that other set has to have those same 4 integers in it. But the power set of Q has no integers in it. It only contains sets. So the intersection of Q and the power set of Q is empty. Q contains only integers. The power set of Q contains only sets. There is nothing they share in common. So they definitely are not a subset relationship. Same thing applies to natural numbers. Questions about E and F? All right, on the flip side, C and D are correct, and most of you got that. Every set is an element of its power set, because every element is its own subset, every set is its own subset rather, and therefore every set is in the set of all of its subsets. We also had a little bit of trouble with these, so let's look at G. I guess we can start with H, but they're very much the same except the quantifier. So this says, for all s in power set of n. What does it mean to be s in the power set of n? It just means that every set of integers. So we're saying every set of integers is equal to the set of all of its elements. This is true by definition. Everything is equal to the set of its elements. It doesn't actually matter what set of sets I'm picking here. If I have a set containing everything that's an element of the set, then I have the set I started with. And so G is true, and by extension H is true, because it's true of every single one. Questions about G and H? Yes?
For G, the empty set is also a set in the father's
set. Yes.
But like, there's no
empty. Correct. So if S was the empty set, then what would I have on the right-hand side? The set of all x's that are in the empty set, which is nothing, which would be the empty set, leaving me where I started. Other questions? Yes?
I just wanted to clarify, so the set of 3, for example, and 3, they're not equivalent anyway.
The number 3 and the set 3 are not equivalent. That is correct.
Okay. It's an element, but it's not.
3 is an element of the set 3, but it is not the set 3. Yep. Other questions? Okay. Everything that is an element of power sets is a set. So we have here for every set of integers, for everything that's an element of the power set of that set, you had to be a set. Because power sets contain sets and only sets. Okay, similarly, they do not contain natural numbers. They contain only sets. That's I and J. Questions about I and J. All right.
Moving right along. K.
All right, I say, is the element, is the set containing just three? An element of the set containing sets of pairs, sets of two elements. Important thing to understand when we're reading this is all this is saying is this is the set of all sets that contain an element of X and contain an element of Y. Sorry, say contain an element X in Q and contain an element Y in Q. And so any set containing just a single element of Q is included, because X and Y could be the same value that is allowed, which is why this is okay. Questions about this one? All right. 78. What is Q set minus Q? The empty set. What is Q union the empty set? Q. It's all the things that are neither Q or the empty set, which is all the things in Q, which gets us back to Q. We have similar things here when we're doing different sets being subtracted. Okay, so when I remove just the things that both the natural numbers and Q share from N, I do the same thing as removing the things that just Q has. That's actually not unique to these sets. I could have picked any pair of sets. This would always be true. The things that Q has that N doesn't, which for this particular example is nothing, but if there were some of those, they wouldn't matter for the set subtraction. The set difference doesn't care about elements on the right that are not in the left. And so this will always work here as well. P was not true, although a lot of us thought it was. What is an example of how the left and the right could be different? Yeah? When A and B have the same element, then is that element on the left? Is it on the right? Yes. So if it's on, if A and B, suppose A and B were both just the set containing the number 3. The set containing the number 3 minus the set containing the number 3 is the empty set. And the empty set over here, we get the empty set over here. But on this side, we have the set containing the number 3. So this doesn't work if there is a shared element between them. We also have another one we had a significant wrongness to is Y here. Q is not an element of the power set of its power set. This comes back to the idea that a power set contains only sets. And so the power set of a power set contains only sets of sets. And so a set of integers is not going to be an element of a set of sets. Yes?
So I have a question on human V.
Yes, please.
So given that X is a member of the power set of Q, X is a set, correct?
X is a set.
So a member of said set would be a number, correct?
Yes, but I'm not asking for a member of X, I'm asking for a member of the set of X's. Right? So power set of Q is a set of sets of integers, therefore X is a set of integers, therefore this is a set of sets of integers. Other questions? All right, I have skipped over some that a significant number of people got incorrect, but I've missed many that a non-trivial number of people got incorrect. I would encourage you, if you don't understand some aspect of this, to seek aid. Go to Piazza, go to office hours in some way, try to understand why this is going on. Much of computing will just assume that you understand sets, even though it can sometimes be a little esoteric. And we'll come back to it occasionally as we move forward, including using some of it today. But we're not planning to spend a lot more time talking about sets directly for the next little while. So, any other thoughts, comments, questions about this, or anything else that's going on before we dive into our material for this week of induction? Okay. One other little administrative thing. It turns out, with relatively short notice, I am going to be out of town on Tuesday through Friday. I've arranged a substitute to come teach you on Wednesday, and we'll have the quiz ready and so forth, so your class should proceed as normally, but I will not have office hours tomorrow through the end of the week. I will try to answer email as best as I can, as I am at a conference these next few days. So just letting you know that, I will also try to make some more posts for the people that aren't here as well. All right. I want to start today by looking at this function. Okay, I've written up here in sort of vague pseudocode, not really any language you've learned, but I hope you can understand it. Here's the definition of a function. Chat with whoever you're sitting next to, see if you can agree what this function does. I haven't told you what type of values it wants. What type of values does it want? Does it always halt? Can it ever run forever? What does it return? Chat with your neighbor. Think about this function. Questions? Anything I can clarify about my vague pseudocode or what's going on here? All right, then let's just ask a very specific question. What is f of 456,789? Yeah?
Zero.
How do you know?
Because what essentially this is doing is it is every time that it will check the if statements, and then it's not satisfied, it'll go to the else statements, which means it'll subtract the number that it's given as an input, and we'll just keep doing that over and over and over again until the if is satisfied.
How do you know it will ever get there?
Because you put a number in.
Okay.
That's just how numbers work.
Is it? Do we know that if we do this several hundred thousand times, we'll ever get to zero? I can do it hundreds of times and run out of patience and never get to zero. Why do we think it will ever get there? Yeah.
Because the order that we put numbers in.
Because we have an order for numbers? Okay. So we're going to talk about this. How do we prove things about code like this today? We're going to start with a simple version of this. We'll turn into a somewhat more complicated version. We're going to teach you a proof rule, a proof technique that is widely used in programming. A lot of code, when you try to prove anything about the code, you're going to need to rely upon this. And while in this case, most of you can look at it and just say, it has to work, we're going to try to teach you why it has to work so you can apply that why in more complicated situations. Yes?
Doesn't there have to be like a while
loop? Does there need to be a while loop? Let's see if we can figure that out. Let's start with something simple. What is f of 0? 0. Therefore, what does f of 1 return? F of 1 is not less than 1, so it's going to return f of 0, which is also 0. And therefore, f of 2 is going to return f of 1, which was 0. So we don't need a while loop. We have instead this, what we call a recursive definition. Our function is defined in terms of itself. And weirdly, it works. We will also show why it works to some degree today. Some other classes, some of you already taken, some of you haven't. We do have classes that teach you how to write programs like this. Recursive functions are an important concept in programming. We're not going to talk about that in this class. But we are going to talk about how to analyze them to some degree. You'll learn more about analyzing them in algorithms as well. Other questions before I prove into the go into the proof rules, etc. Okay. So we're going to introduce a proof technique called induction. Before I introduce this proof technique, let me point out that we've already learned several proof techniques. Let's think in particular about, let's go back to proof by cases. We talked about proof by cases. You have done some proof by cases assignments. The basic structure of proof by cases is if I know A or B, and I know that A proves C, and I know that B proves C, then I can conclude C. And this is how we might write the proof technique, the proof strategy of proof by cases. This proof strategy, when we actually realize it, has subproofs. Notice I have A proves C and B proves C inside. These are their own subproofs. And these subproofs are easier than the original, because in this subproof, I can assume A. I assume A, and then I write a proof. I prove from that C. So this structure of a proof strategy, proof by cases in particular, allows me to make some assumptions. And I can try to pick A and B in such a way that those assumptions make it easier to do my job, which is why proof by cases makes our life easier. It's more steps, but the individual steps can assume more things. I can introduce truth into the two cases, and that can make my life a little easier. So we're going to teach another proof strategy that is also going to have subproofs. Before I get there, questions about proof by cases, the idea of subproofs, and assumptions. All right. Let's talk then about induction. Induction is also a proof strategy. It also is going to have steps like this. This one, however, is going to be based on predicates instead of just general propositions. If I know P of 0, and I know that P of x minus 1 proves P of x, then I can conclude, for all x in the natural numbers, it must be the case that P of x. This is the proof strategy of induction. Okay? And the idea here, the key observation, again, I have a subproof, but my subproof gets to make a huge assumption. It gets to assume part of the thing I am trying to prove. I am trying to prove that P of x is true, and I'm going to assume that P of x is true for a different x. But by structuring it in a careful way, that big assumption, which gives me a lot of extra power in making my proof, will allow me to prove what I want to prove in the end. And the way I do this is by counting. I am counting, I'm giving you a guideline as to how to construct an actual proof for any x you happen to pick. You want to know P of 4? Well, the way you prove P of 4 is proved by P of 3. How did you know P of 3? Well, P of 3 was proved by P of 2. How did you know P of 2? Well, P of 2 is proved by P of 1. How did you know P of 1? Well, P of 1 is proved by P of 0. How did you know P of 0? Ah, I have my own statement of that already. And so we provide this technique by which, if you wanted to, you could follow it all the way back. You give me any natural number, and with some number of steps of this process, we'll eventually get back, everything will be sound, and so we can therefore make this general claim. For every natural number that exists, P has to hold. So this is the structure, the concept of the inductive proof strategy, and it is one of the two main workhorses of proofs in computing. We use this to do a vast percentage of the proofs we do about code, code correctness, what code can and cannot do, how long it takes to do it, and so forth. So, this is the strategy, and then actually using it is going to be a little bit trickier, and we'll try to see some of how this works with various situations as we go along. And we'll go back to the function we were just at here in a moment. Before I do that, though, questions about my outline, my notation, what I mean by assumption, etc. All right. Let's come back to this function. I'm going to start just by proving that it doesn't run forever. Okay? I'm going to prove that f of x terminates if you give it a number. I'm going to start by just saying it terminates if you give it a natural number. We'll get to other kinds of numbers in a moment. So I'm going to write myself here a theorem. It will only officially be a theorem after I prove it. This is probably worth noting at some point. A theory is something you hope is true. A theorem is something you have proven is true. We're going to make this into a theorem by proving it. Okay? So our theorem is going to be f of x terminates, that is to say, stops running for all x in the natural numbers. Before we go forward, I should comment. If you put this in actual code, it is unlikely, possible, but unlikely, that you have a data type that allows you to give it all natural numbers. Most programming languages, their integer data type only goes up to a certain large number. But we're going to prove it for all the natural numbers, and then we could deal with the details of a particular programming language if we needed to. So here is how our proof is going to work. We're going to proceed by induction. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, but we're going to use this inductive strategy. Our inductive strategy needed two things to prove the conclusion. We need a p of 0 and this implication. So that means I'm going to have two parts to my proof. And there's official names for these. We have the base case. The base case is that thing that is true at 0 scenario. Okay, so the base case, I'm going to say f of 0. This is the case I am considering, and I want to show it terminates. How can I show that f of 0 terminates? Well, it just does, right? It just uses the first branch of our if statement, perhaps. How about we can say, because 0 is less than 1, so the function returns 0. There's no magic to this particular wording, but I do have to address some degree why I know that f of 0 terminates, because that's my base case. My base case is the theorem that it terminates is true in the particular case of 0. Okay? That is the first part of my induction. I have proven it is true at 0. Now I need to have my second case. This is called the inductive step. We call it a step because of the idea that we're moving one step at a time. If you tell me it's true at 7, this is the proof that it's also true at 8. It's moving one step at a time. We don't generally call it a case because it's a whole lot of cases. It's all of the cases except the base case. But it's the step we can use to get from one step to another. Now the rule here is I want to say, given x minus 1, prove it's true of x. And so I just get to assume that it is true of x minus 1. So I get to assume that f of x minus 1 terminates. I just assume the theorem at x minus 1. I don't need to prove it. Induction will get me there for it. And now I need to prove that f of x will terminate. I know x minus 1 terminates. I'm just assuming that. And then I'm going to say f of x returns f of x minus 1, which terminates. So f of x also terminates. I feel like I am saying a little bit more than I probably need to. Hopefully this gets the idea across. So this is the second part. Base case shows true at 0. Inductive step
show that if it was true at x minus 1, then it's also true at x. Yes?
Wouldn't this logic also work if you said x plus 1?
Yeah, so there's no magic about the directions, sort of. We'll get to the variations. We can get to it here in a moment. Other questions? Yes? Yeah, so we'll get to various generalizations of this in a moment. We'll start with just natural numbers. We'll move to integers. We'll actually move to real numbers as well and explore various extensions we can do on this basic template. Other questions about this so far? All right, I am not done proving. I have to state why these two pieces fit together. Just like in proof by cases, you had to have that last step that says because it holds in both cases, it holds in general. In this case, I have to say the general phrase is by the principle of induction. And then I can say for all x in the natural numbers is the case that f of x terminates. This magical phrase, by the principle of induction, means I'm assuming you agree we can count forever. Therefore, we can count to any particular number you want, and I have shown you how you can use moving one place at a time to get where you're going. So this idea, this strategy works, is called the principle of induction. And so we just say, by the principle of induction. That exact phrase appears in a majority of inductive proofs I have seen. And that completes our proof. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yes?
Why is it valid to assume f of x minus 1 terminates?
Yeah, how did it make this assumption? Where did that assumption come from? I just made it up. Just like I do in proof by cases. In proof by cases, I just assume p is true, and then I assume p is false. Why can I make those assumptions? They aren't true in general. I'm just trying to say, here's a portion of my overall. So here I'm just saying, if you knew that x minus 1 terminated, then I'm showing you that x terminates as well. And I get this to result in the whole thing because I know 0 terminates. So if 0 terminates, then this step tells me that 1 must terminate, and then this step again tells me 2 must terminate, and this step again tells me 3 must terminate, and I can keep doing that to get you any natural number you want. So I am making a huge assumption. I'm assuming almost the entire proof. And I'm showing just sort of the next little step to create this template to generate giant proofs without having to generate the whole thing myself. Other questions? Yes? When you write prose, you almost always include labels for those. And if you were typing it, you would put them in bold. Yep, we do label them. Other questions? Right. This is pretty close to what we might actually type up. I skipped one piece here. There's one extra piece we would usually say. We would say something like, we proceed by induction on x. You don't have to say this, but in general, when you're about to split into induction, just like for cases, we say we proceed by cases or proceed by case analysis. For induction, we say we proceed by induction. And then we generally will name the thing that we are inducing on, the thing that is going to be at a base case and a higher case in what we're doing. We don't have to do that, but we generally do. It helps people understand where we're going. And this now would be a complete proof of the termination of function f. All right. Any other thoughts, comments, questions about this example before we make it more complicated? Okay, then we'll make it more complicated. So I have this formula.
This is the structure of an inductive proof. There's a lot of things I can do to make this formula fancier. For example, what if I were to make that second step, P of x proves P of x plus 1? Well, that's just fine. X was an arbitrary variable. These two statements mean exactly the same thing. So if you'd rather say assume it at x and prove it at x plus 1, you're welcome to do that. Right? You just picked a variable. There's also no immediate magic to going one at a time. Let's think a little bit about what's going on here. I effectively am saying, hey, there's a number line. And I'm going to tell you how to generate proofs. If you want to know the proof at x, I'm going to show you how to derive that from a proof on x minus 1. I'm going to show you how to prove x given x minus 1. I can, of course, repeat that for as many steps as I want down the number line. I need to make sure that this hopping down the number line stops at something that is true, which is what the other piece does. The other piece just says, I know it is true at 0. So I have a way of jumping one step at a time towards something, and then I eventually reach it. I could generalize this to have a larger bucket of things I am jumping into. Okay? So I could have several items in my base case. I could prove P of 0 and P of 1 and P of 2, and then go down by 1, 2, or 3 each time. And so forth. I can, as long as I'm providing you some steps towards a case where I know you will always bump into the base case by following the inductive step enough times, then my proof works. I could also, if I wanted to, try working it backwards. I could show you how to take from, I don't know, how to get from negative 7 up to negative 6. I could have my steps go the other direction. The only requirement here is that I always show you how to step towards a case I have proven is the base case. I need some inductive step system that will eventually reach the base cases. And if I have that, then induction works. When we formalize it, we generally write it down assuming it's the natural numbers and their base case is 0, but we can use more general versions in practice and still call it the principle of induction. So, let's briefly look at what that would look like for this same function again. Let me remind us what the function was. If x is less than 1, return x, else return f of x minus 1. Let's again prove termination. We'll get to proving fancier things in a moment. Let's again prove termination. But let's prove termination for all of the integers. So we're going to prove it terminates for all x element of the integers. Okay? Now, much of my proof is going to look very much like it did before. But my base case is going to be dramatically bigger. My base case is going to be all the cases I can just prove. So I'm going to have my base case is going to be simply x is less than 1. And then it terminates. I'm going to be very fuzzy in my language here because I want to show several other examples. I know it terminates in the if, right? It immediately returns x for all x minus 1. That takes care of all of the negatives and 0. Huzzah! Huge amounts of space handled. And then my inductive step is going to look exactly like it did before, right? I'm going to assume f of x minus 1 terminates. And then I'm going to say then f of x terminates by returning f of x minus 1. And then I can say by induction, done. This is clearly not a full prose proof, but it shows me that I can deal with a larger set by having this gargantuan base case of all of the negative and zero integers. They're all handled by that first if. Questions? Yeah? Yeah, my base case, how did, what in particular, is there any particular question or you just want me to talk about it? Just talk about it. All right. My base case, I'm picking the cases where I don't have to talk about the function. I can just prove them directly. The cases I can prove directly are all the cases where x is less than 1. So I'm going to say if x is less than 1, then I can say it terminates by returning x. Boom. I don't need any induction. It just directly does it in the code. The code tells me it terminates. I don't need the induction in this case where I need to do several steps to get there. Do you want me to say more? Other questions? Okay. We can prove fancier things and this terminates. Okay? So, I really should have made advanced copies of this. All right. Let's write our if x is less than 0, x else f of x minus 1. I'm getting briefer and briefer in my pseudocode. All right. What number does this return if it's given a natural number? If x is a natural number, what is the return value of this function? 0. And that should be 1, not 0. Sorry, I wrote that wrong. Because the way I wrote it, it would be negative 1. Okay, so if it's less than 0, return it. Otherwise, so I'm going to try to prove it returns 0 for all x in the natural numbers. Yes? What is the set of natural numbers? 0 and up. So that's why I picked the natural numbers. You're absolutely right. Negative numbers will return themselves. We're restricting ourselves for now just to the natural numbers, which are all non-negative. Other questions? Okay. So I'm going to have the same basic structure I had before. My base case is going to be x is 0. Okay. When x is 0, we return x, which is 0. Check. So for my base case, I return 0, which is what I want to do. For my inductive step, I can assume I have already proven the theorem for everything smaller than x. So I can therefore assume, in this case, that f of x minus 1 is 0. That is the theorem. I get to assume the theorem for all numbers smaller than the one I'm looking at. And having assumed it for all the numbers smaller than what I'm looking at, I can say, then f of x returns f of x minus 1 equals 0, so f of x is equal to 0. And therefore, by the principle of induction, for all x element of the natural numbers, f of x is 0. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yes?
So you've been proving that functions can terminate, but how do we prove that something can't terminate?
So proving things can't happen will require a technique called proof by contradiction that we'll get to in a couple weeks. Other questions? All right, so let's do one more thing here. What if I gave it a real number? If I give this function, I don't know, pi, what does it return? Let's do something easier than pi. If I give it 7.8, what does it return? 0.8. Okay, let's see if we can prove that. Let's first try to formalize what we mean. We are thinking that f of x, we're going to try to say for all x element of the positive real numbers, f of x returns what? How do I write what this does? The remainder. So in some programming languages, remainders work for real numbers. In many, they don't, and commonly, they're not assumed to in math either. Remainders are traditionally defined only over the integers. However, we have this fancy functions, which you may or may not have already seen, and in case you haven't, we'll teach them right now. These symbols. I think I actually used one of these in one of your practice questions thus far. This is called the floor. This is called the ceiling. And these mean round it to an integer. Floor means round it to an integer smaller than it if it's not already an integer. Ceiling means round it to an integer bigger than it if it's not already an integer. So the floor of 2.3 is 2. The ceiling of 2.3 is 3. That's awkward because that contains a 3. Let me change those to 1s instead so it's clear that I'm not just picking the other side of the period. Okay? The floor of 2.9 is also 2. The ceiling of 2.9 is also 3. Okay? They don't round towards the closest. They round either down for floor or up for ceiling. Okay? And these functions will show up occasionally, not hugely often, but often enough that it's probably worth knowing them. Before I move on, questions about these functions? All right. I can write what this thing does as x plus 1 minus the ceiling of x. Take a moment, chat with your neighbor, see if you agree that our function does this. While you do that, I'll rewrite the function just so you have it in case you need it. Yes. X minus. Okay. So we have this alternative. Great question. What do we think? We have two versions. Which one is right, or are they both the same? Let's consider a case where they give different numbers. If x is 2, what is the one on the top? 1. What is the one on the bottom? 0. Which one do I want? What does the function return if x is 2? 0. We want this one. These are not the same. We want the second one, not this one. How many of you realized it was wrong? Yes. Let's actually do the easiest case. In the case of 0, f of 0, what does f of 0 return in this function? But this is 0 plus 1 minus 0, which is 1. And this is 0 minus 0, which is 0. We can try that with 1. 1 plus 1 minus 1 is 1. 1 minus 1 is 0. Right? So this one does the right thing when x is an integer. When x is not an integer, they are exactly identical. Right? So I have 1.3. 1.3 plus 1 is 2.3 minus 1. Oh, they're not identical, are they? Sorry, minus 2, which gives me 0.3. And then I have 1.3 minus 1, which is 0.3. So we're not integers, these mean the same thing, but they round differently in the exact integer case. Questions? Yes?
So the ceiling of 2.0 is still 2?
Yes. Yep. If you give me an integer, I give you back the integer. If you give me a non-integer, I round up or down to an integer. Other questions? Okay, let's see if we can do this proof. And then we'll sort of point forward. All right, I'm still going to have a base case. I'm still going to have an inductive step. My base case is still going to be a case I can do easily. The case I can do easily is, this is going to be the case where 0 is less than or equal to x is less than 1. I'm going to try and capture all of the cases which I can solve easily. Now, officially, our theorem doesn't include 0, but we're going to end up giving it 0 because of the second step. So I'm going to include 0 as well. In all of these cases, I simply return x, which is equal to x minus 0, which is equal to x minus the floor of x, which is what I tried to prove. Questions about my base case before I move to my inductive step? Yes?
Are we proving this for all of the positive real numbers?
All the positive real numbers. Yep. It is not true of the negative real numbers, so we won't prove it of them. Other questions? Yes?
Is the base case something that we know?
In general, I want my base case to be everything I can see without having to go through multiple steps. Is a general rule for making a base case. You'll see a few other examples in class on Wednesday. But in general, it's the stuff I need to do that. Another way of thinking is it's enough that I'm guaranteed to step into it. So since this I'm stepping down one at a time, I need to make my window at least one wide. So I'll always be guaranteed stepping one at a time to hit this window. Other questions? All right. So my inductive step, I can assume f of x minus 1 is equal to x minus the floor of x. In the inductive step, I get to assume my theorem is true for x minus 1. Sorry, not x minus x. I need a minus 1 there and a minus 1 there. Let me rewrite that so I can see that clearly. I have to assume the actual theorem. The theorem is the thing I put in there, x minus 1, is equal to the floor of x minus 1. Not equal to minus. There we are. Minus. Ah, get this right. Okay. So I get to assume this thing. And now I need to inductively show that it must be true of f of x. So then f of x is going to return f of x minus 1, which is that thing, x minus 1 minus the floor of x minus 1. And I need to show that's the same thing as x minus the floor of x. How am I going to do that? Well, the trick is I'm just going to use algebra. I'm going to add 1 inside and outside the floor. Adding integers inside a floor does the same thing as adding them outside the floor. So there's other ways I can think of that. I can also think about pulling this integer out. But I can just add inside and outside the floor. And so I can say here, that means this is going to be x minus 1 plus 1 minus x minus 1 plus 1. And I'm allowed to do this because I'm subtracting. I'm adding one and subtracting one because of the minus sign, which is just going to be A equal to x minus the floor of x. And then by the principle of induction, it must hold for all the x's in the reals, in the positive reals. Thoughts, comments, questions? All right. On Wednesday, again, I won't be here, but Professor Brunel, who has taught this class in the past, will come in and walk through a few other examples and exercises. Feel free to bring questions for him. I will see you all next week.